Well, there was big interpersonal communication in cyberspace controversy started by provocateur Adam Jacob. I think he is. We talk about him enough, and that I think we can now call him friend of the podcast.
Wait.
He's been on the podcast. He's been on multiple times.
Yeah.
Well, so
has DHH. So technically, no, they're both friends of the podcast.
Well, yeah.
he was on Software Defined.
But I think a friend of the podcast has mutual bi-directional engagement and kind of awareness and sort of, you know, running around in the same circles. Like, I think that's what makes someone a friend of the pod, or it's someone that you talk about enough and you ironically say they're a friend of the podcast.
We talk about nonetheless, a lot of people.
We're going to call him a friend of the podcast. And may I say, this could be his most controversial take.
Oh, yes.
So Cote, set it up for us. What was the take?
I think there was a, I don't even know who it was from. There was some comment from someone else that they had a policy in their company that if you're in Slack, you're not allowed to send just like a hello or hey, got a sec sort of message. Now,
wait, those are two different things.
Right. Well, and maybe we can get into the weeds of this from the discourse that came up around this. But I think there is a valid concern in there that whenever you're at work, or even worse, in your personal life, and your loved one sends you a message like this, you know, you don't want to get the message that's like, hey, we need to talk. And then that's it.
Yes.
You know, especially in a work inducing environment, you would like to know what is the topic, right?
But I think we should break down the reasons why, because the objections are multi-level here. I think there's first, let's start with the generic hello. Someone just sends you in a Slack or your favorite Teams to chat message. It's just hello. So I think one starting point was like, it's inefficient. Like sending someone just the hello message.
Yes.
Is just inefficient. And that's where I think the original company that Bandit said, like, you know, you're wasting people's time.
It was Google.
So I think it was Google. So it was like,
it was Google. And when you posted like hi or hello, there were kind of those, I'm just going to show my cards right now, passive aggressive assholes who would respond with a link to a doc that explains why you shouldn't just throw that out there.
And we'll put it in here. There's a link. I don't know. We found a link. Someone said this. It says, please don't say just hello in chat. So there's an outline of why. But to your point, Cote, I think there's the initial thing is, I believe where you're coming from, Matt Ray, and where it was from is inefficient. It's like that was a group saying like, you know, you're really, I think their position was like, don't even say hello. Just say, you know, when, you know, whatever you're looking for, like, where is this document? Or like, you know, please answer the following question. Something that's so very direct, absolutely zero, if you will, customary, just kind of greeting. Okay. So that seemed to be one thing. And then a separate issue with the like, hey, got a sec is sort of both. It's both inefficient and at least in some cases, it inadvertently instills maybe some low level anxiety in people. Like you don't know what's coming. Like a doctor calls you like, hey, you need to call me back, and they don't say anything. So I think that was the other. So it's like almost there's like a productivity objection. And then there's an objection of like, you're creating at least low level anxiety in people.
Right. And
it seemed to branch from there.
I think the second one to summarize it is you don't want to scare your coworkers. that is also not productive.
Yes.
And so like, you know, it's good to, you know, to put it another way, right? Like generally in communications, I don't know if it's sliced up through some cultural, subcultural buckets or whatever, but like, I feel like people want to know that they're not in trouble. like what, you know, there should be like, it's almost like in the payload of communication, somewhere in the header of the message needs to be like, in trouble, yes, no. And then it should be just specified if you're in trouble or not. And that would like make so much human communication a lot easier. right? To I mean, figure that out.
Yeah, dogs have it sorted out, right? Yeah, they're like tails wagging, but the fur's up.
I do think it is like an interesting commentary, and I don't know if this is just on tech or maybe it's everywhere. But if it's more recently, feels like it's definitely in tech. It's sort of like we've created a culture such that, like, you know, let's call it the ambush meeting HR thing is like pretty common, right? So like, so, you know, it's, so it's not unheard of for you to get kind of this ambush meeting and something be, you know, something very bad be told to you, like, you know, you're leaving, or, you know, it's some bad news. And it's just kind of interesting that like it's just so prevalent.
Don't go to work on Fridays.
That's to say, but there's so, it's so prevalent in the industry, right? That like, we're all just like, it's just weird that like, we've all understand the culture of like, well, this can happen at any time to anyone in any, and if you believe it can't happen to you, it just, you know, you're just in for a rude awakening. So everyone is always on guard, even if you're like, you know, everything's fine, you're going in, it's a Wednesday, you know, you're like, whatever, you know, and you just, so it's kind of interesting that the culture is such that like this doesn't, I don't know. Well, I was about to say, like, I don't know if it happens as frequently in other places, but maybe it happens everywhere. And this is just work culture in general.
And to give our friend of the podcast his point here, you know, this should be all, as the nerds would say, orthogonal to, you know, being nice and talking with people and being friendly. With
exactly.
your teammates to have a good, you know, the equivalent of like, you know, picking insects off of your coworkers and eating them like gorillas do and chicks. Like, you got to have plenty of that activity. Like when the gorilla fingers are coming towards your back, you don't, you want to know that it's friendly, not that you're about to get laid off.
Adam Jacob, I guess I have to go back, because his position was like, hey, be friendly, just use pleasantries, say hello, say, you know, don't be afraid to go off topic, things like that. So, but I wasn't sure where, if he comes down to like, is he saying that it's best to say like, say hello, followed by like your topic of interest? Or is he just saying like, no, it's fine to just be like, hey, you know, what's up, Matt? You know, that kind
of
stuff.
Well, I mean, he gave examples of, you know, at their organization, they encourage civility and greetings and, you know, a more, you know, greetings and salutations kind of environment. Whereas others, sounds like Google, were like, you know, just get to business, right? No pleasantries. And those of us who are kind of in the middle, right? Who cares, right? You know, if somebody says hello, I'm sorry if you take that the wrong way. But that's how humans function, right?
Yeah.
I get pleasantry followed by like the topic seems like a really nice, reasonable compromise. Like, hey, Matt.
Well, yes.
Who knows it? I need your help on this, you know, XYZ, you know, can you answer the question or call me or something?
Right.
Totally reasonable to me, right?
So those of us who are skilled in social media or, you know, instant messaging, know that you don't just say hi. You say hi and you don't hit enter. Then you put your message. So at least you had it together, right? You don't leave them hanging.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, yeah.
That's true too.
Like, pro tip, it, right?
You have it chained. Yeah. You're like, hey, what's up? And then you follow like, I need help on this, right?
Yeah. You're making me realize when I have the genuinely have the open ended thing, I'll say that. I'll be like, hey, you want to catch up? I don't have any agenda. I just wanted to see what was going on.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I'm sorry that, you know, hi has become a trigger word, but you just can't be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I think what you two are making me think is we need to rehabilitate the hi and just be like, it's almost the opposite take of like, if you've got some official business, don't start with hi. Like, because it's just going to weird people out. Like, don't steal the high from the happy people.
Okay, HR, maybe you don't get to use high.
Yeah, that's right. HR can't say hi. They can only say greetings. I think
like, context and the person sending it definitely matters. Right? There are people for sure that send me hi. Hey, it doesn't create any anxiety. It's just like catching up. It's, you know, it's just, it's totally fine. In fact, it's expected, right? Like,
right.
It's sort of like they're kind of initiating, because it's almost like they're trying to get your attention because they want to initiate some back and forth, and like, maybe it's work related, maybe it's just BS, maybe it's fun, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I just think it's fine, right? It's like, but I think other people, right? If HR does, I think if it's an HR thing, they should always be required to send the full topic of the message.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna put out a proposal that's just a general rule of thumb that anything from HR is always fear inducing.
Yeah,
and basically, if there's any good news, you should get it from your direct boss. And yep. So therefore, anything you get from HR, bad, just delete it.
Just bad.
Not interested.
Bad news coming.
Well, you know, speaking of eating bugs off of your coworkers in your community, you know, the high, getting along with people. You're at KubeCon.
Yes.
Europe, in Paris, Matt Ray.
My community, yes.
Yeah. What's the vibe there? I forget the exact number, but, you know, big friend and listener.
I think I heard 12,000. Yeah.
Seems like there's a lot of people. And I was able to watch, I watched the keynote this morning and I watched some talks from the platform engineering day, which were just lovely. There's three that I like that I'll put links to in the show notes. But as you've been walking around there, is there a lot of high-fiving going on? Is there good swag? What's the intangible stuff that we can't see in YouTube?
I mean, you know, so you watch today's keynotes, which I got to say, I found better than yesterday's, but that's just because of what's interesting to me.
I don't think I'm going to watch yesterday's then.
Well, sorry to spoil it for you. How do you feel about AI? Because you're gonna get a fire hose of it, essentially, is how it works here. Almost everything yesterday was AI related. Today
was AI washing, or was there like, wow, this is actually something?
All the above.
Okay. Because if it isn't something like, oh, Kubernetes or some project can do something really new and special from AI, you know, then it, I don't know. I think we've all probably burnt out on the AI washing stuff. It's like, fine, everyone's doing machine learning. Great. You know, what else can be said about it?
Right. I mean, it's AI washing. I'm sure a lot of it's real. You know, there were folks from NVIDIA who were giving talks. There were, you know, a lot. I mean, there's a lot of it going on, and some of it, you know, there's just such a volume of it that, unless you're, you know, neck deep in it, you probably don't know what's legit and what's just a waste of your time. And I just tuned it all out in my head. Cause you know, it's not my day to day. So I didn't care. And the problem was, it was like most of the content. And so I kind of disconnected from it today, hit on some of the things that are closer to my current interest, which a fair amount of environmental stuff.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I was just talking with a European coworker before this. And after watching that, and then this person brought it up on their own, like, do people in the US care about climate shit in the same way? Because I feel like the Europeans are always on this like energy saving and stuff. And, you know, it's been like almost 6 years since I've been in the US seeing this stuff. But I feel like in the US, they wouldn't give a shit. Like,
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely one of those things like night and day when you compare like KubeCon EU versus KubeCon North America. You know, they all love AI, but Europe, you know, the environmental stuff, it's not just that, you know, they love, you know, trees and stuff. It's that there are governmental regulations that require you to care about, you know, your carbon footprint. And so, you know, I was lucky enough to get to announce it that, you know, the project I work on, OpenCost, was adding cloud carbon support, and I got applause, and that was just shocking that, you know, people were super excited about it.
Like these crazy Europeans. And I'm not even talking about bread.
Now, give us a quick summary of that, because is that basically measuring the carbon footprint of the, you know, of the whatever the application? Like, what exactly did you announce there?
The project I work on, OpenCost, is a CNCF project for monitoring cloud costs and, you know, Kubernetes and cloud costs. And usually it's just, hey, here's the dollars and cents, here's the euros, you know, whatever it might be, here's how much, and then you can break it down into, oh, I'm spending this much on object storage and this Kubernetes namespace costs that much. That's cool. You know, obviously very useful. But what we've added is there's another open source project called Cloud Carbon Footprint that was giving you like the carbon cost associated with, you know, at the data center level, but we worked with them to get them to give it at the resource level. So now we can tell you that type of VM you're using on Intel costs, you know, €2 an hour. And if you run it on ARM, it costs $1 or €1 an hour. And the carbon footprints are also much different. And so we're able to let people know, like, you know, now all, yeah, exactly. What question, the question you asked, can I know what a workload's carbon footprint is like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting because as far as I know, nobody else does it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah,
and it's open source.
Just to chime in here in the U.S., I would say, like, I think it's harsh to say we don't care. I just speak for all of the United States. It's like, I would say it comes up. I see it come up.
It does come up.
It's often, you know, I mean, care is a strong word, so I don't want to be careful here, but I would say it's often mentioned in like the corporate goals of companies. Certainly Apple, Google, Microsoft, they all talk about it, you know, extensively.
That's true. That's true.
And most of them, Matt, you have to correct me wrong. I'm trying to think. I feel like I've seen in some of them, cloud providers, they'll have some metrics that they'll actually count and show you a little bit there. So I don't know if that qualifies as like,
I think you're right, Brandon.
You're aware of it.
My diction might have been a little extreme, which is a rare thing for me to do, but I think maybe this is a good application of the fine scale, right? Like, you know, you'd have not good, fine, pretty fine, good, great, right? Like, and like, it's just a matter of like, is it important or really important? And I think in Europe
much more common in Europe.
By the KLM flight I had back from LA last week, where I saw a video of like how they're just eking out efficiency throughout their system, including having their airline staff wear lighter shoes to get like a 0.1% like lift or whatever.
Oh.
Like, wow. KLM's all over. Air France KLM is all over this.
Wow, that's impressive. KLM, yeah. good for you.
Of course, people are now getting fired for having orthotics.
yeah. Well, have you had any exciting dinners with people? It's always exciting to see how the
to the chase, go take.
How the conference people like are adapting to the local scene, right? Like, you know. Ooh. Like, so last year when people were here in Amsterdam, you know, it says, whoa, look at all these bikes. Like, let me give you an example. I don't know if this actually happened, but like in today's keynotes, there was a lot of beret talk. And in my mind, I was like, I've been to Paris several times recently and ain't no one wearing berets.
No.
So I don't know. I don't know what's up with this.
I saw at least two people wearing berets.
I think they were probably just some Basques who got lost.
They're from the United States. They're definitely from the United States.
You might be right. I almost took a picture because I was like, hey, they're wearing berets. And I was at the Eiffel Tower. But
well, that's fair. That's fair.
They might have been tourists.
Okay. So, you know, I very rarely see berets.
I agree. I have not seen a lot of berets. I would say in general, Parisians, you know, pretty well-dressed. Not a lot of t-shirts and shorts and flip-flops like back in Australia.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Matt, what about the, you know, one of the topics we covered, you know, not too long ago was the whole, you know, Linkerd, you know, kind of their change and some licensing. And actually, our friends over the Cloudcast, Brian had a really nice episode this week about, kind of like CNCF kind of adopting like a private equity stance, which I encourage everyone to listen to. We won't like get into the whole thing, but I just wondered, was there any like, I don't know, this is called like broad like licensing talk or, you know, governance, if you will, like rethinking governance in any way? Did any of that come?
Yeah, I mean, there's we can link to it in the show notes for sure, but there are several threads in GitHub like issues with the CNCF TOC. How to like not let this happen again, essentially, where, you know, you have to maintain certain standards to be a graduated CNCF project. I don't think they can, you know, undo Linkerd yet, you know, and maybe Linkerd will get other maintainers who don't work at Buoyant back. But that was kind of the problem, is everybody worked at one company and that one company didn't want to do all the work for everyone. So I've seen people have generally had, you know, the conversations I've been in around this People are like, I get why Boyan did it, but they shouldn't be allowed to do it. So people are like, they understand that like Bill's got to get paid, right? Somebody has to be paid to work on software. But CNCF is still supposed to be a safe harbor for, you know, independent projects.
Yeah. You know, this is reminding me, Brandon. You got to get that, call up that cloud of judgment guy, friend of the podcast, and be like, I want you to put together like a cloud native and DevOps index. And like, let's track that and see how this stuff is going. Cause it seems like it wouldn't be doing well. I'm especially I think Hashi is rumored to be selling itself around, and then other companies, their value is going down. Like, I feel like if you had invested, if Matt Ray Dalio had sunk the hedge fund money into the DevOps index, I don't know if it would be doing well, especially compared DevOps to other options.
Better than the space index, I got to tell you.
yeah, and in fact, how's the hedge fund's NVIDIA investment doing, Matt Ray? Are you tracking that on the dashboard?
It's going gangbusters. I logged in today. Somebody told me that NVIDIA had bounced up some more, and I'll just say, the money I earned from Chef getting sold has doubled.
Congratulations, Matt.
Because a fair chunk of it went into NVIDIA and Apple and Microsoft.
So my question, though, obviously there's so much coverage of NVIDIA. There's lots of places to go for all the latest earnings and kind of latest chip announcements. But I can't help, and I just wonder if this is just, my experience. But I keep having the feeling of Sun Microsystems and Cisco, in 2000, 99 and 2000, right? It's not that NVIDIA doesn't make money. It's sold out. The chips are going to be sold out for, the next probably 2 years. There isn't any sales. It's just, you're just taking orders from whoever you want and who's giving you the most money in PR. So talk about great to be in sales. It's like, you really are just taking orders. So, but at the same time, I don't know, it feels like it will have this crest. Like, it just reminds me of that Sun Cisco moment where it was like, okay, they made tons of money there, but then finally the internet sort of crested, and then there was the .com crash. And I just wonder how hard it, I don't know, like if I was, Jensen Huang seems like a very confident person, in his black leather jacket. And so, but I would almost be I would wake up every day kind of worried, this run cannot go on this long, right? And so, or maybe it can. I mean, maybe that's the other side of it. So I don't know. Maybe Matt, I'll start with you. Do you kind of have the same kind of feeling that this thing is going to eventually implode in a way like Sun and Cisco did at that time? Or is it, no, this is the future?
I think there are parallels, maybe to Oracle or even Docker, where the rest of the industry resents your success and is going to kind of, stand shoulder to shoulder trying to pull you down. Mm-hmm. And, because literally Oracle databases were printing money, and, eventually other stuff caught up. And that's why I bring up Oracle is just, they were definitely head and shoulders above with the quality of their database. And some people still argue that Oracle database is still the best, but you don't want to pay for it and you don't want to deal with their sales anymore. But NVIDIA still the best, and they've got the roadmap that's ahead of everybody, and everyone else is playing catch up. And AMD played catch up to Intel for 15, 20 years, 30 years. They're caught up now, but the game changed. So, I think NVIDIA, I do have NVIDIA stock, but I also have AMD stock. I think NVIDIA has a big lead over a lot of folks. I also think that I don't have the knowledge and depth or the depth of knowledge to back this up, but I feel like a lot of this, a lot of optimizations are going to come to the AI space that make it less demanding. I mean, people, I saw something the other day that ChatGPT-2 now fits in an Excel spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. They're going, the baseline of chips from everybody else is going to continue to rise. It might not be competitive with the top of line NVIDIA stuff, but also the requirements are going to continue to drop mm-hmm. or become easier to distribute to, you know, lighter things. I was talking with a friend of mine from Ampere, and he was saying, you know, you don't have to use, you know, you don't have to use Intel with those NVIDIA things. And what we're starting to have to worry about with a lot of the AI equipment, especially here in Europe, is the fact that that people are going to want to put this in existing data centers that don't have the power capacity for you know what they could actually fit. And so rather than say like, oh, you know, we've got 12 racks of, you know, gear, and now we're going to put 12 racks of AI gear in, you can only put in three. And, you know, so you'll end up saying, well, you know, I'll cut some corners, or I'll bring in, you know, lesser power hungry equipment that right. can hit the same this capacity. All,
everything you're saying, this is why I guess it's really Sun, right? This is the Sun Linux, right? This is where I just have that same kind of feeling. It's like, well, for a long time, it's like Solaris and Sun, those were the best servers. Everyone agreed. But then it was sort of like over time, it was like, you know what? These other things can do the job a lot cheaper, easier to put in data centers, easier to build your own things. And I think, you know, the other thought I keep having is that, you know, technology markets in general, IT in general, vendors, like there's nothing vendors like to compete on more than speeds and feeds. Like if you just talk to technology people, like that's all anyone would prefer. Like forget about like moats and markets. It's like, I just want to build the faster, cheaper thing. Right. And so when you see a market that is really just all it is about speeds and feeds, right. You see technology people attack in unison. Like you don't see another place. It's not like people are like, I'm going to go build another search engine because they feel like that's really hard. And there's a community versus like, I'm just going to build the chip that is even faster and better than the other one. And that's why I feel like NVIDIA kind of has this target on its back. Like everyone's coming for it, right? Intel, I'm sorry, not, well, Intel's sort of like in the past, but like Google.
No, Intel's coming for it too.
They Google's making its own chips and Microsoft's making its own chips. There's Grok, not the Elon Musk company, but the new chip company. It's like everybody is coming. Like the smartest scientists in the world are like, oh, great, a performance problem. That's all. I don't have to talk to any people. I just have to go in the lab and make the chips faster. I'll see you in 2 years. So that's why it feels like, you know, NVIDIA is going to attract this level of, you know, speeds and feeds competition that we probably haven't seen since basically like Linux and maybe ARM a little bit. That's why I'm just like, gosh, if I'm the CEO of NVIDIA, like I'm worried. I'm like, you can't hire the smartest people.
You should be, right? And that was my point, was that, you know, the industry is shoulder to shoulder saying these guys can't succeed without us, or, you know, we can't let them have it. We can't let them have it all. And, you know, that, you know, here I am at the Kubernetes conference instead of the Docker conference.
That's right. That's true. So, well, Cote, the other thing I wanted to get your take on, unrelated to the technology, was just that Jensen Huang recently gave an interview, CEO of NVIDIA, and just some things that came out was that he has 55 direct reports. They do no written reviews. There are no one-on-ones, and he has no meetings with his directs alone. Everything is in groups. So I was just thinking to myself, because it's like, well, anytime there's a major successful company, everyone starts to adopt some of those. I was just wondering, can we just start to pick and choose the ones that we want? Like, I don't really like the 6-page memo. So I'm like, great. But I like this. No written reviews. Love it. Check. That would be fantastic. No one-on-ones. Like, I don't know. I could go either way. Depends on your boss. Like sometimes you want to, sometimes you don't. Sure. And then, but the 55 direct reports, like that seems crazy. I was like, well, this one seems a little too extreme. I don't know. But do you, Cote, do you have 55 direct reports?
I hope not, because I never talk to them. So
you're doing it right. I think you're doing exactly how you would do it.
Well, that neither does Jensen Huang.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was trying to have a take on this when I was looking at it, but just my brain just shuts down at the concept. And I'll tell you the sound of shutting down. So it seems like, you know, I'm all for flat organizations and questioning what managers and executives even do, like based on my interaction. No one currently, it's not based on anyone currently that I interact with, but in the past, at other places I've worked at, I'm always just like, I don't know if this is helping whatever we're doing here. But, you know, if you had 55 reports, that implies that you are you are adding value to 55 lines of activities that themselves branch off into more lines of activities and on and on and on, right? And so it's one thing for an executive to have their, whatever you want to call it, their ELT, their executive team, and sort of have like, let's say five, I mean, let's take out like the back office. I don't mean that as a pejorative way, but let's
take out HR. They're still on our shit list.
I mean, you got to have HR, corporate, you know, corporate legal, and finance is more of a chorus thing, but you know, you've got these lines, and then in Europe, your sustainability officers. So you've got those things, which are like important, but they're more like condiments for the business. So you've got like five, six people as a CEO, maybe, that you're dealing with. And like, that seems extremely difficult. And then you have the second line people, you're always dealing with the second down, whatever. But like with 55 people, like, I don't even know what you do with that. Like, you probably, and also there probably is a chief of staff and at least one executive admin. Right. So like, there has to be someone determining traffic stuff. And if there's not, then I don't know what that looks like. Like, do people just like, what are you even doing with 55 people? I can barely manage three kids, a wife,
some very informal, journalism, I would say research. Okay. So this is what I've kind of heard about NVIDIA. It's like very difficult place to work. Right. And while all of this is probably true, I believe everything he says. Like, I have heard though that the style is more like, if things are not going well or there's information that's needed, it's likely you'll get a phone call at any time of night or day from Jensen Huang asking you about something, right, along the line. So it's just sort of like it's more like 50. I would maybe say, from what I heard, it's like probably 55 people on call. Right. It's like, listen, we don't have a standing meeting or anything, but if I need something from you, or if, you know,
I believe
things are going well, like, I'm just going to initiate a phone call, which I guess is technically not a meeting. We get into some semantics here, right? But it's sort of like, I'm just going to pick up the phone and we're going to talk until this is resolved to my satisfaction, or, you know, something, or I'm going to take somebody's action. So I think that's kind of really more what it's like. And if you think of it like this, it's sort of like the person at the top isn't so much managing. It's sort of like, they just, you know, it's more like almost like a political person where it's like, I just need information at any moment's notice. You report to me. We're not going to talk a lot, but when I call, you call me right back and you give me the answers. And that's sort of how the business rotates. And maybe there's long periods of time where whatever thing you're responsible for isn't an issue. And you probably go like months without talking to them, but then,
go ahead. I could see with a model like that, like, I was kind of offhandedly talking about, like, you know, I don't know what you call it, but like, you know, if you had a team of five people and each of those five people has like, you know, five to six people working for them and on and on and on, like, oftentimes you would be working with people like three, maybe even four levels down. And so at some point, maybe you're just like, why do I have all this middle management? Like, every now and then I just want to talk with this person. And, you know, they should know what they're doing. And if everything's cool, I don't need to talk to them. So, you know, sure, that there's something there. Now, the other thing, and, you know, as you two know, I don't care about chips. And so, like, I'm not really sure what this is. But like, I mean, don't they just make like a couple chips over there? Like, they got a few product lines. Like, it would be one thing. Like, if you have a small product set, I could see that you could have a lot of reports, because it's sort of like, we're all working on one of 10 things that are just like chips versus like, you know, if you went to Microsoft and you got all the SKUs that Microsoft has, you would have to have like 300 direct reports or something. If you followed this model, like, if, you know, like, you're going to, anyways. So if you have a smaller product set and, like, sure, I can see that.
I would say they don't have a small product set. They, you know, they have all their AI chips, and then they have, you know, general data center grade server chips, and then they're networking, And then there's a lot of like specialized chips on top of, you know, data accelerators. And so they've got all the, they have a wide variety of different server grade chips, you know, for various things. And then you mix them into different combinations.
I mean, I always figure like a chip company just has three things. They have like works faster, fucking fast. And that's no, pretty much their line, right?
Yeah. They've got a wide variety of different chip products and ways to combine them. And then some of those turn into like, they're practically full on servers. You know, when people are talking about like a $200,000 GPU, it's not just, you know, it fits in a PCI slot.
So they got
to announce the latest chips. So I guess they're going to cost more than $30,000, I guess, for them. But I do think maybe kind of the middle ground there is a sort of like they're all within the, to Cote's point, there's all within the same domain. It's not like large conglomerate that's sort of like, you know, Amazon's got like a video
right.
Retail business and, you know, the cloud stuff. So it's all in the same thing. And I guess the other thing I just would throw out here is sort of, and I think we should like just look at all of these comments, like, you know, because the, what is it called? The hagiographies will be written about, you know, the greatness of like, because it always follows, this kind of success always follows with like some incredible report about the greatness of the leader. But I think we could just kind of apply here. It's like, you know, when you're winning at this level, you can do anything you want. You could have 1,000 drivers. Like, when the chips are sold out for the next 2 years, right? Like right. There are no pipeline calls. It's like, the pipeline had like literally everything has been sold for the next 2 years. So those kind of meetings, you know, you don't call the salesperson because there's nothing left to sell.
Well, you do. So you're on the queue for, you know, in 2 years.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, he's definitely entered into Steve Jobs territory where he's going to have this, you know, oh, he was such a great leader. And it's not till, you know, further down the line, they're like, you know, actually the guy was just a dick and he, you know, was on top of everything. He was on top of the turnaround at the time, and you know he gets all the credit, as well he should, but also like the dude was not an angel by a lot of accounts. He was not a great leader, but you know he captured that lightning. And you know, maybe Jensen Huang is a great guy to work for. I don't know that one way or another, but if and when there's some sort of like, you know, end of the story or, you know, decline in the story, things will start to come out. We're like, you know, maybe this was a bad idea, but you know, but it didn't matter because they were printing money. Well, right?
Whatever we do, like I still want to maintain the no written reviews. That was genius. I'm gonna be like, hey, like 20 years from now, when people I'm like writing stuff in Service Now or whatever the HR system, Workday, and like I'm trying to cut and paste and it won't work, and you know, and no one's reading and everyone's just like clicking around. I'd be like, remember what Jensen Huang said, everyone. No written reviews.
Right. You can put on your black turtleneck, like, you know, like, let's think different about writing these reviews.
I wonder if my attempt to get out of Workday. I just like whenever I'm in there, like typing stuff, I'm always like, I don't think this is helping to anyone, but like, I know we got to do it.
I think we should. It would be great to interview whoever the head of UI at Workday is, and just be like, hey, no offense, but what were you thinking? like what is going on here? Because and it's like, you know, I don't like it, but I also don't understand it. So I'm interested in whatever worldview this is that you're operating under. Like, what is the theory behind?
Is it an accretionary UI?
I'll give you the theory. I believe it's all comes back to the defaults lifestyle, because if you look at where the Workday UI comes from, it comes from the Word template that predated it. Whereas everyone had to like, you know, there was like five questions and you had to fill it out. And probably the Workday UI and product people were like, no, let's come up with a new system. And they probably rolled it out and people were like, this isn't what we need. We need the form that we used to use in Word. And this kind of reminds me back to like, it becomes like just the inertia, right? You can't get rid of things. And I think of this in context of here in the United States, you know, for a little bit, they were getting rid of the SAT and ACT, like kids didn't have to use them for college anymore. But now a few years have gone by and it's like, no, colleges is like, we got to have it back. You know what I mean? But there's all this stuff about like, you know, we could do it a different way. You could do it a different way, but they need those scores back. So all the college kids will have to take it again. And I just kind of feel like it's the same thing. Like, human bureaucracy requires this written form. Like, you, it's not the system. Like, you can't take it away from an organization. As soon as you do, the organization tells you why you need it again. It's almost like, if you will, the DevOps culture talk at the highest level of a company. It's like, no, I know what we just said. We're going to be different, but we still need you to write this down in a Word like looking format. And it will probably be like that forever. Sadly.
Well, you know, this reminds me of one of my business bullshit dictionary entries, bureaucracy, just process you don't like. Whereas like there's a process that you do like, no one ever calls it bureaucracy. They don't call it anything. It's just what you do. Now, also, I'm thinking maybe this no written review thing, a positive version might be that someone had this idea and they went to HR in NVIDIA and they were like, what if we don't have written reviews? And the HR person, maybe if they were like, you know, one of these subject matter experts who's like interested in the sort of life of the idea. And they were like, I'm so glad you asked that because no one has ever questioned that assumption. And I've been waiting for someone just to come in and say like, why don't we not have one? And I would say like, exactly. Why don't we not have a written review? Do you know how much money we put into that? How much it slows us down? Yes. The legal hurdles that we have. If we had no written reviews, it would be more efficient and probably better. So yes, I as head of HR say, no need for that. Just be nice. Just call someone up and say, hi, can we have a meeting?
Yes. Or maybe Jensen was like, I don't have time. There's 55 of these. I'm not reading them. Don't do them.
I can only do 8 of these in a year, and I've got 55 people who work for me.
You do, exactly. you do feel like this is direct. You know, there's always the causation correlation mistake, but this feels like direct causation. When you have 55 direct reports, you just have to institute the rule. There are no written reviews because you would never finish. You never
get them. Read them. Yeah.
You couldn't even get them all written, much less reviewed.
Yeah. Well, as one final item, we got a bunch of notes or links in the show notes. If you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/459, we're almost up to 460. That's exciting. But I was digging around doing some research, and I found this IDC market forecast for container infrastructure software. Now, it's a little squirrely. I shouldn't say squirrely. It could be more clear in its definition of what that market is, but I think Kubernetes is part of it. Just Kubernetes on its own. It does say this doesn't include the operating systems you run in the containers for Kubernetes. That's the only exception, but that makes sense. Okay. But their estimate of the market size for container infrastructure software, and this is spread across the firewall, public and on-premises, in 2024, oh, I can't do math this fast. This is going to be terrible. Is basically about $2 billion. And that then it's going to go up in 2027 to $5.5 billion. And I don't, this is why I spent a lot of time looking at the definition, because I mean, isn't it supposed to be bigger? Otherwise, what are we doing here?
It feels like it's, I mean, because reportedly Red Hat has said that OpenShift is a $1 billion business. But does OpenShift not count because it's more than just Kubernetes? Is that, yeah, I mean, they, is IDC sliced. Just, you know, they're like, well, we'll let you have 20% of that because also there's, you know,
I would assume so.
Management.
I assume this is the blinking cursor Kubernetes where you just stand it up and it's sitting there. Right. But then does that include your networking manage? I guess it doesn't see, this is in my mind. Like
it's a ridiculous chart. I mean, because if you say like, okay, how do you measure the cost of EKS on Amazon? Is it the $20 a month management fee? Or is it, you know, the EC2 nodes that it's running?
I think that must be what it is. There's just like this thin layer that takes your YAML and then hands it off to some other market that actually installs all your software and runs it.
Yes. Somewhere there is an IDG. This is IDG, right? There's a landscape. IDC. Yes. There's an IDC landscape document that shows the handoff, and it just happens to look like the CNCF.
I guess maybe the broad point is like, I think we're coming to Cote. It's like, hey, this seems really small, but like, because we kind of, when we add up all the cloud, you know, spend, I think last time we did it was like $200 billion, right? Sort of like that's sort of the annualized revenue of all the major clouds, right? So, but like, I don't know. I mean, anecdotally to me, like this does make sense. It's like, I just talked to so many customers and stuff, and it's like Kubernetes, fun to talk about why people are deploying like VMware and EC2 and just like traditional infrastructure. And it's like, I don't know. I think there's something this is really kind of calling out. It's like, I think we kind of get to like all this cloud native stuff. And I know you're at KubeCon, Matt. I'm sure there's like tons of vendors there, but it is always come back to me. It's like, this is not being adopted the way the way you would almost feel like because of all the talk, right? It just, I'll constantly question myself, like maybe I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I'm not in the right place. But when I go talk to like other people in the industry and other vendors and stuff, it's always like, yeah, it's never as much as you think when you kind of dig behind the scenes. So
well, I think they're slicing this down too much because I think if they're like, this is Kubernetes. Well, I work for a Kubernetes cost monitoring company, and I know that, I think the number's been publicly said, like, you know, our customers manage more than $3 billion in cost of, you know, with our software. That's not all Kubernetes, but is it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is just like a truffle thin slice of what's going on.
I mean,
here. And I think as you're saying, Matt Ray, if we treat this market as like the YAML handoff market, then that probably it's a huge market for just like, you know, moving files around.
Well, but I'm saying, like, when do you stop counting it? Is my point. Is like, when your YAML's talking to a database, when your YAML's talking to something else, you know.
And I think maybe one, again, it all depends. Maybe one possible conclusion, as I think both you and I are saying, Matt, is that there is this core of Kubernetes, which basically the world has decided to make free. Like people, there might be a lot of usage, but there's not a lot of paying for it. And instead it's all this other stuff around it, below and
which is fine,
going back to it, I use phrases like that. And I'm like, yes, I sit around and I'm like, I always like remembering this. I, in this kind of context, I frequently remember the Kubernetes documentary where I think it was Joe Beda is basically like, yeah. He doesn't talk like this, but he was like, yeah, we had to like take out Amazon. So here we go. So that would be a great result of like, we wanted to use open and free and have a good technology that would basically nullify the proprietary nature of like the biggest cloud out there. And, kind of remove the end result of that kind of strategic move is that you have a tiny market in that thing that you've commoditized.
But I mean, here we are at KubeCon and there's literally, you know, 1,000 talks or whatever. And most of them are not about Kubernetes.
Exactly.
Well, there I still go. Think it would be interesting. The chart I would love to see is applications and or workloads on Kubernetes versus total applications.
You'll never find it, Brandon.
Go ahead.
But I mean, there are organizations like a Workday or an Adobe or, you know, so many of these huge SaaSes are running on top of Kubernetes. So when do you stop counting?
Well, I'm just saying, like, just as a total, sure, I agree. There are large companies that are doing it, but I just think if you go further out and be like, let's look at all the workloads that are deployed in the world right now, like what percent are on Kubernetes and how much is that?
I would love to know the percentage. Doesn't need to be the dollars. It just needs to be the percentage.
That would be the interesting number. Cause then you see
that's the number we want.
Maybe I can dig it up for the show notes, but the only people I've ever seen do this, Gartner has this. They've done it twice where they estimate and forecast exactly what you're saying, Brandon. Total applications and workloads globally. I don't think they have it in near Earth orbit.
There's a lot of Kubernetes in space.
They have an estimate of how much. It's not even Kubernetes, it's containers, which you can kind of extrapolate.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
but running in containers. I mean, if I can construct a spreadsheet in my head quickly, I think by now in March of 2024, it would be in a range of 15 to 20% or maybe 12 to 18%, like is kind of what their estimate is. And also to what you're saying, Matt Ray, like the first thing I would want to do is pull out all the tech companies and then reevaluate it. Right. Just because or at the very least, let's pull out Google and Facebook. And
I don't think Facebook uses Kubernetes.
Or no, but again, it's containers, right? So you will want to pull out like
I don't know if they do that either. Yeah.
Well, sure.
Oh, it would be good. I don't know. It sounds like a good work for Matt Ray because he actually has some access to some data. Maybe there's in there. Maybe the first cube cost annual survey thing can come out and like break it down anonymously. Give us a sense of what's happening.
Well, let me there's a few conferences coming up. I want to get to the recommendations here, so I'll just go through this quickly. We have a conference, the Tanzu Redefined thing in person. that you can come attend to go over what's up with Tanzu. There's also an online version on April 3rd. If you're interested in those, I've put a lot of effort into doing them, so you should care, at least for that reason. But if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/459, you can find them. And then I'll be speaking at NDC Oslo and DevOps Days Birmingham. The date has been moved to August 19th to 21st. And I'll also be speaking at DevOps Days Amsterdam. And there's another conference here, but we'll put that there. And do we have any bureaucracy, Brandon?
We do. I want to thank some people that wrote in for stickers. I sent some to Simi in South Africa, Jason, Ohio, another Jason in Nevada, Brian in San Diego, and Chris, very close to me here in Texas. So if you would like a sticker, just send your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com. And also, Chris told us in the Slack that the official, I'm calling it the official water bottle of Software Defined Talk, the Owala water bottle, is on sale on Amazon. So if you're in need of a water bottle, I have it. I just used it recently on a trip. You should go get it while it's on sale. So check all that stuff out.
Listen, and I want to apologize to the listeners who like routine. Usually we do bureaucracy first, and then we do conferences. But I wasn't looking at the clock, so I was trying to wrap up quickly. But I think we have enough time for our usual thing. So if you need to, you can rewind, listener, and you know, you can, if you need that satisfaction.
You can cut and paste it in there. All right, nice.
That way you can
use the chapter markers to go back and forth if you want.
There you go. Now, speaking of chapter markers, what do you have to recommend this episode, Matt Ray?
Well, one little bit of bureaucracy that slipped through is I'm actually going to be speaking at the Open Source Summit next month in Seattle. So I'll be joined by a very large enterprise user of the open source software I work on. So that's exciting. But my pick for this week, I bet Brandon picked it before, but it's DuckDuckGo, the search engine. I recently just switched all my browsers to it, just to see what it would be like. And then I forgot about it and it just was fine. So, you know, all the talk we've given about enshittification and the quality of search, it's better. Yeah. So check it out. That's my point, is just, maybe try changing your default browser search to DuckDuckGo and see how you feel.
You know, I look at those open source conferences, especially the OSS Summit every year.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, man, I need to figure out my job situation where I have a reason to go speak to those. Now you, it makes sense because you actually work and do open source software stuff.
Right.
But like me going, I don't have there's no ROI for my day job to just go there and speak at it. So, I'm wrong.
It's a weird conference.
I want to go talk at those conferences. That'd be fun. It's
a weird conference because it's got five or six tracks that don't really have a lot to do with each other except open source. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah,
you know, maybe the Linux Foundation needs to set up a ROI for conference speakers. How do you say it? Major domo, where if you're in this situation, you're like, I really would like to go, but I don't see how this relates to my job and I can't justify it. You would file a ticket with this office, or maybe you would just send them a message and be like, hey, do you have a sec? And and they would help you discover why you should come speak at this event. And
yeah, no, I think there's absolutely, as a vendor who has sponsored conferences before, I would love to have, here's your expected ROI. Here's the number of qualified leads you're going to get. You're not getting that.
Well, no, yeah. not even that. Just as a speaker, how does this relate to my day job in a way that I can justify it? But that would be, I'll put that in my fantasy land, right next to having 83 direct reports that I manage. So how about yourself, Brandon? What do you have to recommend this episode?
A couple things here. So I did some traveling here. I always like to see travel efficiency, if you will, in real life. So I went to Cancun here. So the e-gates are now available in Cancun. So if you are a U.S., Canadian, or a Mexico citizen, you can just walk up and you can use the e-gates, where you just scan your passport, and then you walk into a little kiosk. And Cote, here's the thing you have to do. You have to look down to make sure you stand correctly on the yellow shoes in the floor so that you're actually, if you will, looking the right way. So of course my wife goes through, does it perfectly. I'm actually get in the kiosk. I'm actually really interested in it. I'm kind of looking around and just want to see how it all works. And I don't stand in the right place. So then I had to like come out and go through the regular thing. So, but I was just, I thought it was great. I was like, wow, this is, I think you said this a while back, you know, governments, if you will, have the opportunity to affect more people through digital transformation than anything else. And like it did for people that can go through the e-gates. It was a huge time saver. So if you're going to Cancun or any other airport, I guess in Mexico, they're rolling it out. Definitely do it, but look down, make sure to find the yellow shoes. And I just want to re-up my, my longstanding recommendations, global entry on the U.S., just a miracle. I mean, it doesn't get any better than just staring at a camera that you can't even mess up. It just like by the time you like you figure out the camera, it tells you just to move on. So it was fantastic. And mobile passport control is available in Austin Airport. Didn't need it because I had the global entry. But they actually, credit to the flight attendants and the airline, they actually recommended it. They said, hey, download this app when you get there.
Nice. It'll
be a lot faster. And I think looking at the line, most people did not take their advice because there was a long line. But if you had, you would have probably been out maybe just 2 or 3 minutes after a global entry person. So check all those things out. If you're traveling, travel's getting slightly better, if you will, I think, in at least in Mexico and Austin. So check those things
out. Yeah, when I was traveling to and through the States last week, I was amazed that you just like get your face taken. You have like the photo recognition, not only for global entry, but sort of for TSA.
Yeah,
like that's true. It's pretty wacky. So my recommendation, I think, is I said at some point I was going to get a new laptop, and I got a MacBook Pro 14-inch November 2023 with the Apple M3 Max and 36 gigabytes of memory. Now,
Cote.
My initial review is a little probably predictable, which is like, I can't really tell. Like, it's fine.
Okay. Like, dare I say you may have over-provisioned yourself a little bit here?
Well, yeah. Probably. I mean, I think, and I've only done this once, but I rendered a 60-second 4K video, and it took like 3 minutes. I thought it would be faster, but I guess 3 minutes is fast. I'm not really sure, but I think
I've rendered,
my computing experience has been fantastic.
I've rendered down video to like 1080p, and it takes about the same clock wall time as the video.
Yeah. But I was thinking like maybe when I finally install an AI locally, it'll play Dungeons and Dragons faster. I think maybe is what I would do.
I got to ask, Coach, it was just like, hey, is this the biggest thing you get within your budget? How did you arrive at the M3 Max?
Yeah.
That's hard. That
and that much RAM. Like yeah. Google or Apple gets you on that RAM.
Yeah. Well, here's what happened is where was I? Was it Dallas? I think I was in Dallas. I think, yeah, it was Dallas because I went to a mall in Dallas. And I went to the Galleria and the Apple store. And it's what they had.
Okay.
I think they had that.
It does not get any more default lifestyle than that.
They had the lowest one. And I'm like, I'm not going to buy the lowest one. Right. No. Like when I was looking online, I actually wanted the Apple M3 middle one. I don't know what the middle one's called, the Pro. And they had this. So that's what I got.
All right. Well, good. Yeah. Well, it looks like you got the 30 core GPU. So, Cote, you should be all set for video, you know?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I wish I could say that's going to turn into more video for Software Defined Talk, but probably not. We were probably not limited by the GPU. That was probably not our issue.
Yeah, so if someone can recommend actually installing some local AI thing that just works like a normal chat thing, like, you know, several months ago, I tried to install like the Facebook Olama, and it was just like telling me I need to use curl, and I'm like, I'm fucking out, right? Like, not interested. So that's what I need.
Curl's too demanding for that old laptop.
I mean, ideally there's like a DMG file I click on, it goes into my applications folder, I click on it, and there's a window, and I can just start chatting with it, and it's persistent. Works.
Wow. Okay.
Why that doesn't exist, I'm very confused. Like, I don't know. We got to get one of those 55 reports needs to get on top of that. Well, as always, this has been Software Defined Talk. If you're interested in seeing the show notes for this episode, including links to those conferences that I just went through really quickly. If you like conferences, you should go check out the list. You can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/459. There's also a great Slack community, very active during the week, that we collect links in, have all sorts of other conversations. I think there's a bit of a discussion about the largest smoker in the world. But you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/459, join the Slack community, and you can find out where this gigantic smoker is located. And also book recommendations, other things like that. We'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So I recently was traveling, and for the first time ever, I actually ended up getting my son travel insurance because he was in Europe and required for his visit. And it dawned on me, I have never done any of this. I've never gotten travel insurance. So I wanted to ask both of you, who are now frequent travelers and living abroad. I'll start with you, Cote. Do you get travel insurance? And if so, what's your rubric for selecting what kind of insurance?
No, I never buy travel insurance. Now, of course, my work has it. Like they have.
Yeah. You get, I know it, if they you have get it on your work trips.
They have stuff. Yeah. But no, personally, the only, and I looked this up, the Dutch insurance I have covers internationally. So there was a point where I was like concerned about that. But of course they do, because they're like Europeans. They're like, hey, you got a problem with your body? No problem.
All right. So follow-up question. This is what I was told. And again, I totally could be wrong. Is I heard people, like, in someone said that if you live in England, trying to be specific here, right? That was like that the English, they felt like, yeah, they bought like annual travel insurance or something like
that.
They travel so frequently.
That, yeah. In Europe, buying these like little insurance things is very popular. Like they got insurance for everything. And I've looked at like the travel insurance, and it really is, well, it's basically just like the kind of stuff of like if you have tickets canceled or like you need to call a cab.
Right.
And so it's like, it's like, I don't need that.
I mean, I get that from my credit card.
Well,
yeah, I get some of that, but
exactly. That also makes sense because that kind of credit card doesn't exist in Europe.
Take the work out of it for a second, because I think work's always a different thing. Work, your company often has benefits. So if you're taking your family, in your case, if you were taking your family to Paris, and obviously you're now located in Australia, like, would you get the family travel insurance? Like, what do you do?
Okay, so I don't buy travel insurance when I'm traveling anywhere except to the U.S.
Okay.
And so, Cote, that was kind of my question. You said, you know, oh, your insurance covers it. Does the Netherlands have like a national health care, and then there's like private insurance on top of that? That's all the like esoteric.
Yeah, yeah. It's
and, all, and where is that, and who's paying for stuff?
I would describe it as it is extremely regulated private insurance.
Mine too.
To the point that it's basically just a commodity, right? And
yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, but like, yeah, I looked, and it's just like, yeah, if you're abroad, just send us the bills, sounds bonkers.
Mine doesn't do that. Mine does not do that.
But it's probably also the case that, like, I mean, this is how insurance works, right? Where they're just like, yeah, on a single data point thing, it can be absurd. But then if you smooth it out over all of the Netherlands, not a big deal.
Yeah. So
Australia, I don't know.
Yeah. The national health cares, all of the countries, most of the countries that have it have like a shared,
reciprocation or something.
Yeah, reciprocation. So, for example, if with my Australian National Health, they call it Medicare, you know, not to be confused with U.S. Medicare. If I go to Japan and I get sick, Medicare will cover that.
The same, it's like
because Japan has it. But you know what? If I go to the U.S., I get fucked.
Okay,
I
should look into this then.
For my family. When I go to the U.S., because of experience.
Got it. Okay. So I just want to recap this. So it sounds like, I don't know, we're just gonna say most countries that have national health insurance, let's just like try to make it like as generic as possible. Many cases that there'll be some reciprocation amongst those countries. And it sounds like in Europe, this is especially the case because obviously, you know, it's all just Texas in Europe, right? It's just like everyone's going between different places, but it's not that far, right? So, and then for some reason, the English seem like they do buy these travel insurance things.
Yeah, it's probably not much.
I think if you were to separate out health insurance abroad from travel insurance, that would be the important distinction. I think it's part of the culture over here, and you know, whether they consider themselves Europeans or not, whatever, the culture and the UK, like that you buy these little insurance things because they're really just like, you know, 2 or 3 euros a month, right? And like,
oh, wow.
And so like the gamble there is less of a gamble and more of an investment over time that like, sure, over 20, 30, 40 years of your life, you're going to pay, I can't do this kind of math, but you're going to end up paying 4,000 euros than you would if you hadn't have got it. But then that's 4,000 euros of not having to stress out about shit.
Got it. Right? But you're talking, like, that's mostly for like covering like your logistics. You're like,
right. And so for example, I pay, because again, this is what you do. I pay for roadside assistance, basically, and you can buy roadside assistance for only the Netherlands or like for all of Europe, globally, right? Oh, yeah. And so like the difference is like a euro, right? Like it's not a big deal.
Nothing. It's not.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and then again, there's also insurance for like lost luggage, like the kind of shit you get on a credit card. It's exactly that. Where you're like, you look at it and you're kind of like,
yeah, whatever. Right. All right, but the health insurance. So it sounds like the U.S. Unfortunately, once again, we're sort of unique in this. It sounds like health insurance in the U.S. is obviously totally different. So if you don't have a U.S. health insurance and you're coming here, you probably need travel insurance.
There's
no reciprocation, right?
Because I had like my travel, my credit card travel insurance, and my wife, someone in my family.
Someone in your family needed it.
Very sick, and we had to go to like an overnight 24-hour clinic, and our travel got delayed because she was sick before we had to travel, and the insurance, the flights were fine, but we had no U.S. health insurance.
Okay, interesting.
And so now, like, I pick up for a family of five for 2 weeks at Christmas, it was like $150 or something. Okay. And it was a combined travel and
Because that's the way they seem to do it. They package it all together.
Oh yeah, it covered everything, and my credit card was only covering like the travel bits.
Well, so, I gotta go look at this. This is a new thing to worry about now.
Well, that's kind of how, this is exactly, maybe it's just like you get to a certain age. Maybe it's also just having the family and people pointing out things you have to do because you're not just thinking about yourself. But like, that's what I learned. I was like, okay, so I would like to throw it out to the audience. Anyone is like, hey, if you are someone that has figured out this travel insurance, this health insurance stuff, for any of these situations, but obviously it sounds like the U.S. is the most complicated, find us in Slack or send us an email about like what people should be doing. What's the correct way to do it? What website we should all read up on it? So I'm trying to get more educated on it. So